on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israel has approved a U.S. negotiated ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon aimed at ending nearly 14 months of fighting linked to the Gaza war. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Have some good news to report from the Middle East.
Hours after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his security cabinet signed off on the deal.
This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities.
It would be the first major step toward ending regional unrest after Hamas's attack on Israel more than a year ago. President Biden hopes it can lead to a ceasefire in Gaza, too.
Over the coming days, the United States will make another push.
Still in the hours leading up to the cabinet meeting, Israel carried out its most intense wave of attacks on the Lebanese capital and suburbs, signaling it aims to keep going after Hezbollah before any truce takes hold. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli cabinet voted Tuesday to approve the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah, which will take effect on Wednesday at 10 a.m. local time. Speaking on Israeli TV, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel retains freedom of movement to attack the Iran-backed Shia militant group if it violates the ceasefire. Israeli troops will gradually withdraw from South Lebanon, and acting Lebanese Prime Minister Naguib Mikati said 5,000 Lebanese soldiers will be deployed there. Netanyahu said the ceasefire will enable more than 60,000 residents who have been displaced from their homes in northern Israel to return. But some Israelis are skeptical that the ceasefire will really mean the end to Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA News. Moscow awaits Donald Trump's inauguration amid escalating military tensions with Ukraine and Western powers following the Kremlin's use of a new nuclear-capable missile against Ukrainian positions. Elizabeth Chernoff narrates this report from Ricardo Marquina.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement to the world in November that Russia had fired a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile at Ukraine raised further questions on why the escalation is happening only weeks away from the transfer of power in Washington. Putin said the Russian missile firing was a response to the outgoing Biden administration's permission for Ukraine to fire American-supplied missiles deep inside Russia. He said it was meant to show Russia can strike far into NATO territory if it wants to. The Kremlin accuses outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden of sabotaging President-elect Donald Trump's efforts to broker a quick end to the war, as Trump promised to do during his campaign. But some in Washington say Russia is not interested in stopping the war, with or without Donald Trump in the White House. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Trading partners Mexico, Canada, and China are warning U.S. President-elect Donald Trump that his threat of imposing hefty tariffs on goods would harm the economies of all involved and would risk aggravating inflation. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Trump made a surprise announcement on Monday for a 25% tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico, as well as an additional 10% levy on Chinese goods until they clamped down on drugs like fentanyl and migrants crossing the border. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Tuesday said imposing tariffs would cause inflation and job losses and suggested possible retaliation. The United States is by far the dominant destination for vehicles made in Mexico, with up to 79% of them heading north across the border, while Canada is America's biggest supplier of crude oil. Tariffs are paid by the companies that import goods, even though Trump frequently and incorrectly says that tariffs would hit foreign nations instead.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Rescue operations at a building that collapsed in Tanzania's commercial capital have ended after 10 days as the number of dead rose to 29. A government spokesperson said on Tuesday the owner of the building in Dar es Salaam was arrested and investigations into the November 16th collapse are ongoing. More than 80 people were rescued from the four-story building that housed dozens of shops. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
deal is reached.
Effective at 4 a.m. tomorrow local time, the fighting across the Lebanese-Israeli border will end.
Russia unleashes its biggest drone attack yet.
Dozens of drones were targeting the capital from different locations.
And the world reacts to Donald Trump's tariff plan.
The first and most for us to do, perhaps, is to continue the good relation and momentum between our two countries.
Today is Wednesday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Starting off today with big news in the Middle East, it looks like a deal has been reached to end the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. However, there is no indication the deal will hasten a truce and hostage release deal in Gaza, where Israel is battling the Palestinian militant group Hamas. White House bureau chief Patsy Wittakusara has this report.
After days of Israeli strikes on the capital of Beirut and other cities in Lebanon, and rocket fire from Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah into Israel, a ceasefire between the warring parties lauded by U.S. President Joe Biden Tuesday.
Effective at 4 a.m. tomorrow local time, the fighting across the Lebanese-Israeli border will end. Will end. This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities.
Biden spoke following a speech by Benjamin Netanyahu earlier on Tuesday. The Israeli prime minister agreed to a ceasefire after over a year of cross-border clashes initiated by Hezbollah over the war in Gaza, where Israel is battling Hamas, another Iran-backed group.
With the United States' full understanding, we maintain full freedom of military action. If Hezbollah violates the agreement and tries to arm itself, we will attack. If it tries to rebuild terrorist infrastructure near the border, we will attack.
Netanyahu said Israel needs to refocus attention on its operations in Gaza following Hamas' deadly terror attack on Israel last October and the threat posed by Iran. But there is no indication the truce in Lebanon will lead to a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas.
Over the coming days, the United States will make another push with Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, Israel, and others to achieve a ceasefire in Gaza.
In an address to a United Nations forum Tuesday, Iran accused the Israeli government of war crimes and genocide and welcomed the recent arrest warrant for Israel's leader issued by the International Criminal Court over the war in Gaza.
We are all obliged under international law to assist the Palestinian people in their lawful and legitimate struggle to secure their right for self-determination against occupation and apartheid.
Under the ceasefire, Israeli forces will retreat south of the Lebanon-Israel border, while Hezbollah will move north of the Litani River. The plan calls for the Lebanese army, which is not involved in the Israeli-Hezbollah fighting, to patrol the region between the two warring sides. The U.S. and France will help monitor ceasefire violations. Patsy Wittakusara, VOA News, Washington.
News of the deal was treated with cautious optimism on the streets of Beirut. Aliyah lives in southern Lebanon. She says that, God willing, Israel is credible and honest because they change their minds every day. And God willing, we will get back to our homes and to our land. For details from the Israeli side of the border, we turn to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein.
Well, Netanyahu said that Israel maintains freedom of action in Lebanon and that the United States is supporting Israel, and that if Hezbollah tries to violate the ceasefire terms, then Israel will attack. From what I've heard, it's not going to be all that simple. Israel has to report any violation to the Lebanese army, which is then given a chance to disarm Hezbollah or take care of whatever the violation is. And then if Hezbollah does not do that, then Israel would be able to react. Netanyahu said that it will give Israel the chance to focus on Iran now. It's not clear exactly what that meant. And he also said that it will free up the sort of weapons pipeline, which had been held up because of Lebanon, something that U.S. officials said they did not agree with his characterization of the situation.
And what about Hezbollah on Lebanese territory? I know one of Israel's demands was for them to withdraw west of the river. Is that part of this deal?
Yes, north of the river, not west of the river, north of the, yes, one of the demands that Israel had was that Hezbollah would withdraw north of the Litani River. That's what's called for in UN Resolution 1701, which is what ended the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, but it wasn't enforced, and now apparently it will be enforced. The expectation from Middle East analysts that I spoke to is that Hezbollah wants time to rebuild itself. It wants time to sort of reestablish itself in Lebanon. In the last couple of months, we've heard more and more voices coming from within Lebanon who were angry at Hezbollah, who say that Hezbollah has brought a lot of destruction on Lebanon. More than a million people have had to leave their homes. So I think there is a sense from both Israel and Lebanese civilians that they really want this ceasefire to take root and to continue.
And speaking of the Lebanese and Israeli civilians, we've heard from some Lebanese civilians who are optimistic, cautiously optimistic about the ceasefire, but they don't seem to trust Israel. Is there a similar distrust towards Hezbollah on the part of Israeli citizens?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, on the Israeli side, about 60,000 people had to leave their homes right after the war started. In other words, when Hezbollah joined the fight on October 8th, and have been living in hotels and rented apartments and other places now for 14 months. And Netanyahu said that the ceasefire would enable them to return to their homes. But many of those people who were displaced on the Israeli side have said they're not going to rush to return back. In addition, there's a lot of damage that has to be repaired. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. In certain areas, certain towns are not really habitable. Others, people could go back, but I think people are very hesitant and won't do so, at least for a few months.
We'll have to leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for taking the time to be with us on what is no doubt a very busy afternoon for you and a very dynamic situation. Thanks again.
Thank you, Steve.
Turning now to Europe and Russia's war in Ukraine. On Tuesday, Russian forces conducted the biggest drone attack on Ukraine of the war so far. For VOA, Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
On Tuesday, Russia conducted the biggest drone attack of the war so far on Ukraine, launching 188 drones across the country. The city of Kyiv was one of the main targets of the attack. Dozens of drones were targeting the capital from different locations. My neighborhood was under attack at around 1 a.m. The explosions were heard and seen quite close to my apartment building for around 30 minutes. The city of Kyiv was full of light from the air defense rockets. It was a feeling of the fireworks, but accompanied by the sound of the approaching drones. Local authorities reported that the main targets of the attack were energy infrastructure objects across the city, but no casualties or damage were reported. However, the attack caused considerable trouble in the city of Ternopil in the western part of the country. The area did experience a couple of attacks before, but it is considered one of the regions less affected by the war. This time, critical infrastructure was heavily damaged, leaving the city of 200,000 people and the surrounding region with no electricity. Gleb is originally from Kyiv and moved to Ternopil with his family at the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion.
Last night, Ternopil had the largest attack since the beginning of the war.
He told VOA this was the largest attack on the city yet. The whole city was in complete blackout for 16 hours. The electricity, water supply and heating were off. The public transport was not functioning either. He said the electricity was back for 2 hours and then off again for an indefinite time. He also said they don't know what to expect in the upcoming days. His wife Titana said the explosion happened at 1 a.m. local time. Their friends, who live close to the epicenter of the heat, shared they were hiding in the shelter and bathroom of their apartment and that the moment of the explosion was very loud and scary. Right after the explosion, the electricity went off, caused by the heat in the critical infrastructure of the city. President Zelensky wrote in his Telegram channel that each of the 188 drones had at least 85 foreign components, without which the drones would not be able to operate. He said that this is proof that such attacks are possible only because Russia and those countries that supply Russia with drones can bypass sanctions. He urged Ukrainian allies to increase joint efforts to make sanctions work in full. Also, President Zelensky reported that the rescue operation at the site of the shelling in Sumy is ongoing. The attack there caused heavy damage to a vehicle service station, a residential building, and a kindergarten. Two people were reported killed. However, the rescue operation is ongoing and more people could remain under the rubble.
Захиститись від цього реально тільки знищенням російської зброї.
Zelensky reported that according to preliminary information, it was a multiple rocket attack. He said that the only effective way to protect Ukrainians from such attacks is to eliminate Russian weapons and Russian launchers directly on Russian territory. That is why the ability to strike Russian territory is so important to Ukraine, he added. Meanwhile, Ukrainian media reported that the Minister of Defense of Ukraine, Rustem Umerov, is planning to visit South Korea to hold talks on arms assistance. Analysts expect Seoul to take a cautious stance on the request after Donald Trump's election victory and Moscow's repeated warnings against such actions. The reported visit would happen amid the strengthening of cooperation between Russia and North Korea, and with North Korean troops participating directly in the Russia-Ukraine war. There were no official comments from either Ukraine or South Korea officials yet. VOA cannot verify information about the reported visit independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And as the drones fly in Kyiv, in Moscow, they wait for Donald Trump's inauguration amid escalating military tensions with Ukraine and Western powers following the Kremlin's use of a new nuclear-capable missile against Ukrainian positions. Elizabeth Chernev narrates this report for us by Ricardo Marquina.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement to the world in November that Russia had fired a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile at Ukraine raised further questions on why the escalation is happening only weeks away from the transfer of power in Washington. General Sergei Karakayev, chief of Russia's strategic missile forces, emphasized the destructive capabilities of his new missile.
Based on the task set and the range of this weapon, it can reach targets across the entirety of Europe.
Putin said the Russian missile firing was a response to the outgoing Biden administration's permission for Ukraine to fire American-supplied missiles deep inside Russia. He said it was meant to show Russia can strike far into NATO territory if it wants to. Observers say the missile attacks are part of both Russia and Ukraine's strategy to show strength and arrive at negotiations on the strongest possible footing. The Kremlin accuses outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden of sabotaging President-elect Donald Trump's efforts to broker a quick end to the war, as Trump promised to do during his campaign. It is an accusation that Russia has made before. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Of course, in 2016, Trump's first weeks in the White House, in terms of his plans for a normal dialogue with the Russian Federation, were undermined to a large extent. I don't rule out that this desire to foul up the situation is what we're seeing now.
But some in Washington say Russia is not interested in stopping the war, with or without Donald Trump in the White House. Russia specialist Vladislav Inosemtsev at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This war has already become the new normal for the Russian elite, who want it to continue because it generates economic growth. And if it stops, what will happen? Where will the people who are now in charge go?
In the meantime, a new poll by the Yuri Levada Analytical Center in Moscow suggests Russian public opinion appears to be shifting in favor of negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. Across Russia's border in Ukraine, a recent Gallup poll finds that an average of 52% of Ukrainians surveyed would like to see their country negotiate an end to the conflict as soon as possible. If these opinions hold, the field may be open for Trump to push through his plan and get both sides to negotiate a truce despite the current escalation. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
On Tuesday, President-elect Donald Trump signed the required paperwork to allow his transition team to coordinate with the existing federal workforce ahead of taking office. The overdue agreement was supposed to have been signed by October 1st, according to the Presidential Transition Act. The agreement is a critical step in the process meant to ensure an orderly transfer of power and limits the risk that the new administration could find itself unaware of ongoing programs and operations.
Nika Novak, a journalist who once worked as a freelance reporter for the U.S. government-funded Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, was convicted by a court in far eastern Russia of cooperating with a foreign organization and sentenced to 4 years in prison. The human rights organization Memorial has described the 24-year-old Novak as a political prisoner.
Four Pakistani security troops were killed Tuesday in Islamabad, run over by a convoy of protesters seeking the release of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Thousands of Khan's supporters marched on the capital, breaking through barricades in response to his call for a sit-in protest near Parliament to press demands ranging from their leader's release to the government's resignation.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Turning our attention now to American politics, President-elect Donald Trump made a largely unexpected pick to run the world's largest military. He nominated Fox News television host and Army veteran Pete Hegseth to be defense secretary. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
Pete Hegseth is a decorated Army National Guard veteran who served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. But the former weekend host of the TV show Fox and Friends has no previous experience in government or in running a large organization.
Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery is with the Foundation for Defensive Democracies.
I think this is an extremely unusual pick. This is not a starter job. And, you know, you would expect someone coming in this job to have a significant amount of managerial experience.
Hegseth raised his profile by hinting at several changes to the Defense Department, opposing the Pentagon's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, which he has called woke.
There is no black, white, or brown in our ranks. We're all green, and we all bleed red. Our strength is not in our diversity, but in our unity and in our love for our nation, our families, and most of all, each other.
Hegseth has also suggested removing women from combat positions.
I'm straight up just saying we should not have women in combat roles. It hasn't made us more effective, hasn't made us more lethal, has made fighting more complicated.
Marine Corps researchers compared all male and gender integrated combat units from 2014 to 2015. They found the all male units were faster and stronger, but the gender integrated groups had better problem solving skills. Morale remained the same. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had this message to the women now serving in combat positions after completing the same grueling task as men.
Well, I think our women add significant value to the United States military. We need you. We have faith in you. We are appreciative of your service. And you add value to the finest and most lethal fighting force on Earth.
Trump has praised his Harvard and Princeton-educated pick as tough, smart, and a true believer in America. After Hegseth's nomination, reports surfaced of a sexual assault allegation from 2017. Hegseth paid the accuser at the time, he says, to avoid publicity. He also says the encounter was consensual.
The matter was fully investigated, and I was completely cleared, and that's probably it.
A Senate majority must confirm Hegseth's nomination. While Republicans currently hold the majority by three seats, analysts say that doesn't guarantee confirmation, with a stance against women in combat that many in Congress see as outdated.
Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery.
As I look at the senators, you know, you have Senator Joni Ernst there, herself a female combat veteran. I'm sure she'll have some interesting questions for him about his opinions on that. So from my perspective, that's going to be a very challenging issue.
President-elect Trump had rocky relationships with defense secretaries in his first administration. One of them, former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, has called Trump unfit for office. Officials say Hegseth's loyalty to Trump is strong. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Continuing our look at U.S. politics, on Monday, President-elect Donald Trump sent shockwaves across the nation's northern and southern borders, vowing sweeping new tariffs on Mexico, Canada, as well as China, as part of his effort to crack down on illegal immigration and drugs. However, it's not clear how serious Trump is. Some analysts suggest that the president-elect is using the threat of sanctions to get leverage to get Mexico, Canada, and China to crack down on illegal drugs and migrants making their way into the U.S., even though the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, which Trump signed in 2020, specifies duty-free trade among the three countries. That hasn't stopped world leaders from taking the threat seriously. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Tuesday said Canada must stay united against the threat by Trump to impose tariffs and notes that his Liberal government has 4 years' experience of dealing with the first Trump administration.
One of the really important things is that we be all pulling together on this. The Team Canada approach is what works. That's where putting aside partisanship, that's where I reached out immediately to Doug Ford to agree with him that we would have a first minister's meeting this week to talk about the United States. Talked with François Legault and some other premiers as well. There's work to do, but we know how to do it.
Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said on Tuesday she intends to send a letter to Trump.
Ahora, si aún así hay aranceles.
She says now, if even after there are tariffs, what we are saying is that it is going to affect the U.S. economy and U.S. companies that have been here in Mexico for 80 years. So it is better that we have a dialogue and come to an agreement on all these issues and others that are relevant. And we have a plan anyway. Sheinbaum says she was willing to engage in talks on the issues, but said drugs were a U.S. problem. She has also suggested Mexico could retaliate with tariffs of its own. China's ambassador to Australia, Xiao Shan, said Tuesday the United States policy on trade with China will have an impact felt globally, as Trump announced he planned to impose an additional 10% tariff on Chinese imports.
The first thing most for us to do, perhaps, is to continue the good relation and momentum between our two countries and see what we can do together to promote for global trade instead of compromising our respective national interest and our common interest.
In an AP interview, North Carolina State University supply chain management professor Robert Handfield says the tariffs would hit a wide range of products in the U.S.
All motor vehicle parts would be impacted. Computers would be heavily impacted. Heavy-duty trucks, you know, the trucks that carry our goods around the country, you know, natural gas would go up as well. You know, we also see, you know, major household appliances. A lot of those come from Mexico, refrigerators, dishwashers.
Trump says the tariffs, 25% on all products entering the U.S. from Mexico and Canada, and an extra 10% tariff on goods from China, would be one of his first executive orders when he takes office.
And finally today, some good news to report from Sudan, as 700 trucks full of humanitarian aid are on their way. Reuters' Sean Hogan has more.
More than 700 trucks are on their way to famine-stricken areas of Sudan as part of a major scale-up of aid. That's after clearance was given by the Sudanese government. The army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been locked in conflict since April 2023, causing acute hunger and disease. Both sides are accused of impeding aid deliveries. They blame each other. The World Food Programme's Lenny Kinsley said the fleet will be clearly labelled in the hopes access is granted.
In total, the trucks are carrying about 17,500 tons of assistance, enough for about 1.5 million people for 1 month.
14 areas of the country are facing famine or are at risk of famine, including Zamzam Camp in the Darfur region. Kinsley said food began arriving there on Friday with a second convoy on the way.
My colleagues on the ground in Zamzam Camp told me that people were lined up on the side of the road cheering as these trucks rolled in. They tell me that people in the camp are resorting to extreme measures to survive.
Despite the celebrations, the aid is considered a drop in the ocean compared to the need. Many parents are mourning the death of children who died from malnutrition, Kinsley said. On Monday, the head of Sudan's sovereign council said he would allow airports in army-controlled areas isolated by the fighting to serve as humanitarian hubs for UN agencies to facilitate deliveries.
That's Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting for us.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.